Joe got lined up by the world a token. Teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And teach the world to snuff the fires and the liars. Hey, I know it's just a song, but it's fast for the recipe. This is a love attack. I know it, our body's back. It's just like any fat. It retracts before impact. And just like fashion, it's a passion for the wizard and hip. If you got the goods, they'll come in by it. Just tears because the baby's life has been revoked. The bond is broke, got so choke up and focus on the close up. Mr. Wizard can't reform. No god like Hocus Pocus. So don't sit back, kick back, and watch the world get bushwhacked. News that's in your neighborhood is under attack. Put away the crack before the crack put you away. You need to be there when your baby's old enough to relay.
Good evening, folks. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, streaming online, www.freakradio.org. For the next couple of hours, it will be Canada on Cannabis with yours truly, Craig Canada. This is the show that believes the prohibition of marijuana is a crime against humanity. I have a blog and our webpage for the show, and the address for that is www.palmspringsbum.org/blog. That's www.palmspringsbum.org/blog. And from there, you can see some of the shows as posts on my blog, and also up in the right-hand corner in the right sidebar, there's a menu, and it says Home Broadcast. What was that noise? Home Broadcast, Bookshop, and Contents. And so if you click on Broadcast, it will take you to the show page with the archives. For the show, going back to February, I've got about 20 of them. I have two in the middle of last month that I have not put up yet that I'll be putting up soon. I spent the week moving the files over to radioforall.net. And so they're no longer residing on my server, and got rid of 2 gigabytes, almost half of the storage on my website. Just couldn't afford to... store the shows on it anymore at 100 megabytes each. And speaking of which, if you go to my show page, and the address for that is www.palmspringsbum.org/blog/canada-on-cannabis, CANADAON-CANNABIS. That's the page for this show here, Canada on Cannabis. There's all my archives there listed there. And down at the bottom, there is a donate button, a PayPal button where you can donate if you'd like. And I pay for this out of my pocket, so if you want to help me offset expenses. And speaking of money, Free Radio Santa Cruz could use money. You can make checks payable to P.O. Box 7811 Santa Cruz, California 95061, or go to their website www.freakradio.org. And in addition to a listen button there, there's also a donate button somewhere, and you can donate there. Last week I had Dennis Perrone on the show. He and John Entwistle spent a couple of hours with me. And it was a good show, and that is up on my archives now. And Dennis was facing child porn charges, and they were dismissed last week, last Wednesday, as a matter of fact. I sort of pre-announced that. When I called Dennis up last week, I thought he had said the charges were dismissed the previous week, but they were dismissed last week. And I pulled up a couple of articles here I thought I would read. He may or may not call in tonight. I know when I spoke to he and John Entwistle last week, they said something about calling in this week, and they may or may not. I just sent him a message on Facebook inviting him to call in, and we'll see what happens. Let me just glance at these articles a minute. Actually, what I think I'll do, since it's Sunday, since I need to kill a few minutes, where is it? Here we go. One took over the line. This was Lawrence Welk in 1961 or 1971 or something like that. And by the way, one toke over the line does not mean like stumble drunk or three sheets to the wind. What one toke over the line means is the sweet spot. It's like just that point where it's just, well, there's no point in doing anymore. So here we have, as Lawrence Welk declared 40 years ago, a modern spiritual.
Dale Farrell from Durand, Oklahoma. Dick Dale from Algona, Iowa. Excuse me, let's listen to Gale and Dale and one of the newer songs.
One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Who do you love? I hope it's me. I've been changing, as you can plainly see.
I felt the joy and I learned about the pain
that my mama said. If I should choose to make a part of me, would surely strike me dead. And now I'm one toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
Don't you know that we're a-waiting
for the train that goes home, sweet Mary,
hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
Don't you know that we're a
sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
And there you heard A Modern Spiritual by Gail and Dale.
And you're listening to Canada on Cannabis on Free Radio Santa Cruz. As I was saying earlier, child porn charges against Dennis Perrone were dismissed last Wednesday. And for those of you who don't know who Dennis Perrone was, he was a gay political figure in San Francisco. He was in Harvey Milk's clique. He was been very prominent in San Francisco politics and in activism for many, many years, for decades, for 50 years. Well, he's 66 years old, so 50 years. This article is from the Weed Blog, and it was posted on August the 7th. As predicted, charges dropped against Dennis Perrone. It didn't take a psychic to see that charges against California medical marijuana brainchild Dennis Perrone were frivolous from the beginning and would be dropped. According to a story I was emailed from San Francisco's ASA chapter, the charges stemming from an August 4, 2010 raid on Dennis Perrone's home have been dropped. I knew it was going to happen, a relieved but tired-sounding Perrone said. Quote, they couldn't meet the burden of proof. This case against me was completely fabricated. Erica Derrick, spokeswoman for the DA's office, released the following statement, quote, we dismiss the case against Dennis Perrone today because additional investigation of the computer forensic evidence does not allow us to meet our burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. They dragged my name through the mud for a year, and now I'm going to sue them, Perrone vows. I'm going to sue the San Francisco Police Department for $1 million. Quote, it was mine, I grew it, and I was in the presence of smoking, he said at the time. But he long denied any connection with the drugs or the naughty pictures, which were of, quote, fully clothed girls. Perrone, who has been openly gay since the 1960s, told us. What's more, they were found only through a forensic search of a computer hard drive's deleted files on a machine used by a guest, Perrone said, and were pretty damn tame. Quote, these pictures were like Macy's ads, quote, he says. They manufactured a drug case and a porno case just to hurt me. For what reason? I don't know. Perrone pledged this will be the last time he will ever be raided. I said that the last time, but now I hope it's true, he says. I'm never going to give them any reason. I'm only going to rent the place to rich Europeans. I will never rent to serviceable locals who might be doing drugs. I assure you, nothing but Boy Scouts here. But he did pledge to return to court, this time as the plaintiff. Quote, I'm going to sue them, SFPD, and anybody else. They soiled my name for no reason. That was from the Weed Blog, published on August 7th. And there's another article here. It somewhat repeats some of that, but it goes into more depth. This is from the San Francisco Examiner. It was also published in the Sunday paper, August 7th. Today's August 7th. Actually, it was published on August the 3rd, 7:00 p.m., and I guess that would be Wednesday or Thursday evening. This is, again, the San Francisco Examiner, and the title is San Francisco Pot Activist Dennis Perrone's A Child Porn Case Tossed. Child pornography and drug possession charges against gay activist and medical marijuana guru Dennis Perrone were dismissed Wednesday after prosecutors admitted the evidence against him was weak. A year ago today, police raided the bed and breakfast where Perrone lives, seizing suspected methamphetamine, ecstasy, and marijuana, and computers they said contained images of child pornography. Now, a year ago today, that was on August 4th that he was raided. That was the 15th anniversary, 14th anniversary, 14th anniversary of the raid of the San Francisco Cannabis Buyers Club in 1996. It was raided on August the 4th. So 14 years later, on the day of the raid of the San Francisco Cannabis Buyers Club, 14 years later to the day, Dennis Perrone is raided in his home in San Francisco. And Dennis and John talk about the raid talked about it on my last show. And so if you want, I urge you to listen to the archive of that show to hear them talk about it themselves. In June, continuing with the article from the San Francisco Examiner, in June, prosecutors were ordered to make a seized computer hard drive available for defense examination. But as of Wednesday, Perrone's team had not received it. That's odd. In June, prosecutors were ordered to make a seized computer hard drive available for defense examination, but as of Wednesday, Perrone's team had not received it. At a hearing Wednesday at which prosecutors were expected to explain the delay, Assistant District Attorney Leslie Cogan told the Superior Court Judge Gerardo Sandoval that all charges were dismissed. After completing further investigation, Cogan said, the people have determined that we are unable to sustain our burden of proof. The case was investigated by officers from the San Francisco Police Department's Juvenile Crimes Unit and Mission Station. Several of the cops from the mission have been accused by public defender Jeff Adachi of involvement in the theft of valuables from suspects during drug raids. They and other officers accused of illegal entry and falsifying police reports are still under federal investigation and have not been charged. However, prosecutors have dismissed more than 100 cases because of the officer credibility issues. District Attorney's Office spokeswoman Erica Derrick said Perrone's case was dismissed due to additional investigation that included computer forensic evidence. Derrick said the child pornography charges were the primary part of the case against Perrone, and if he had only been charged with drug possession, her office would have dismissed those at the time of the misconduct allegations. The 66-year-old Perrone said after the hearing that police have been after him for years because of his advocacy for gay rights and medical marijuana. There was no case, Perrone said after the hearing. It was only designed to tarnish my name. Kitty porn, that's the worst thing you can accuse someone of. The computer was located in a guest room, and Perrone adamantly denied he downloaded the images, saying that he doesn't enjoy pornography and noting that, as a gay man, girls don't interest him anyway. He also claimed the confiscated drugs were not his. His lawyer said he was allowed to view the 33 images on Perrone's computer in the presence of police, and most were of girls. Some were pictures of fully clothed children, some were not illicit, and some of it was potentially what they say it was, he said. However, Wilton added, we've always said from the beginning that Dennis did not have sole access to that computer. As to Perrone's allegations that the San Francisco police were targeting Perrone because of his political stance, Derrick responded that the child pornography case initially came to our attention because of an investigation by law enforcement from out of state. Nonetheless, Perrone said he's now thinking of suing the police department. They dragged me through the mud, and now I'm going to make them pay for it, he said. The article continues under the subheading, FBI Still Probing Police Misconduct Alleged in Raids. The misconduct accusations brought by public defender Jeff Adachi and other defense attorneys against several San Francisco police officers early this year remain, for now, just that, accusations. The FBI is continuing our independent investigations into allegations regarding officers assigned to Southern Admission stations, FBI spokeswoman Julianne Son said Wednesday. SFPD has been cooperating with us since the onset of our investigations. Adachi unveiled the first of a series of surveillance videos of drug raid arrests, most at residential hotels in the south of Market, Tenderloin, and Mission neighborhoods in early March. Defense attorneys alleged that the videos showed plainclothes officers illegally entering hotel rooms without consent in some cases, or stealing residents' valuables in others. They also were claims that officers falsified police reports based on inconsistencies in what the videos depicted. Prosecutors have since dismissed about 120 cases involving arrest by those officers due to credibility issues. Should the officers be called to testify in those cases, according to the district attorney's office? Allegations against a group of Richmond district officers accused of similar tactics in a March arrest were not deemed credible by prosecutors. The officers from the Southern and Mission stations remain on administrative duty during the investigation, police spokesman Sergeant Mike Andrachek said. Well, I'm glad to hear that Dennis is, the charges are dropped and Dennis can go on to other things. From talking to him, it seems like he's going to be opposing whatever the National Cannabis Industry Association, the proponents of Prop 19, are going to be putting on the ballot this year. I see that Steve Cubby, has made some conflicting claims about whether he's going to be resubmitting his initiative or not. I was just looking for some stories about that. What I think I will do is, before going to that, look for some more music. I don't really feel like doing a show tonight, quite frankly. And it looks like nobody's listening on the internet. I just am looking here, and I have no listeners online. There was one listener online before I came. I have no idea how many are listening on the FM, if any. I'm going to play La Femme d'Argent for you, because it's here. You know, this article isn't really about marijuana, but it caught my eye. It's about Fukushima. It's from, where is this from? Straight.com, Vancouver's online source. It's, the title is Japan's Fukushima Catastrophe Brings Big Radiation Spikes to BC. It was published August 4th, 2011. After Japan's Fukushima catastrophe, Canadian government officials reassured jittery Canadians that the radioactive plume billowing from the destroyed nuclear reactors posed zero health risk in this country. In fact, there was reason to worry. Health Canada detected massive amounts of radioactive material from Fukushima in Canadian air in March and April at monitoring stations across the country. The level of radioactive iodine spiked above the federal maximum allowed limit in the air at four of the five sites where Health Canada monitors level of specific radioisotopes. On March 18, 7 days after an earthquake and tsunami triggered eventual nuclear meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan, the first radioactive material wafted over the Victoria suburb of Sydney on Vancouver Island. For 22 days, a Health Canada monitoring station in Sydney detected iodine-131 levels in the air that were 61% above the government's allowable limit. In Resolute Bay, Nunavut, the levels were 3.5 times the limit. Meanwhile, government officials claimed there was nothing to worry about. The quantities of radioactive materials reaching Canada as a result of the Japanese nuclear incident are very small and do not pose any health risk to Canadians, Health Canada says on its website. The very slight increases in radiation across the country have been smaller than the normal day-to-day fluctuations from background radiation. In fact, Health Canada's own data shows this isn't true. The iodine-131 level in the air in Sydney peaked at 3.6 millibecquerels per cubic meter on March 20th. That's more than 300 times higher than the background level, which is 0.01 or fewer millibecquerels per cubic meter. There have been massive radiation spikes in Canada because of Fukushima, said Gordon Edwards, president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. The authorities don't want people to have an understanding of this. The government of Canada tends to poo-poo the dangers of nuclear power because it is a promoter of nuclear energy and uranium cells. Edwards had advised the Federal Auditor General's Office and the Ontario government on nuclear power issues and is a math professor at Montreal's Vanier College. In a phone interview from his Montreal home, he said radiation from Fukushima will lead to higher rates of cancer and other diseases among Canadians. But don't panic. Edward cautioned that the risk is very small for any particular individual. It's not the risk to an individual that's the problem, but how much society is at risk. When you're exposing millions of people to an insult, even if the average dose is quite small, we are going to see fatal health effects, he said. Some impacts may have already occurred in North America. Infant mortality in 8 cities in the U.S. Northwest jumped 35% after Fukushima, according to an article by internist and toxicologist Janet Sherman and epidemiologist Joseph Magano on the Counterpunch website in June. The number of infant deaths rose from 9.25 per week in the 4 weeks prior to March 19 to 12.5 per week in the following 10 weeks, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control data. There's been a dismissiveness about the long-term hazards of nuclear power, said Dr. Curran Wharf, adolescent medicine division head at BC Children's Hospital. Worf was on the board of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning U.S. anti-nuclear group Physicians for Social Responsibility before he moved to B.C. in 2009. These were some of the most advanced nuclear power plants in the world, but a natural earthquake and tsunami rendered their safety measures completely meaningless, he said in a phone interview while on vacation in Tofino on Vancouver Island. It's not clear what health impacts British Columbians will face from the fallout from Fukushima, Worf said, but he added it should be a warning to Canada, the U.S., and the rest of the world about the vulnerability of nuclear power plants to natural catastrophes. These things have typically been dismissed in much of the planning. Dr. Erica Frank agrees. The main concern I've had is we are not paying attention to Fukushima as a warning sign. Given the catastrophic long-term issues and what to do about nuclear waste, I had hoped it would be more of a wake-up call than it was, said Frank, a professor of population and public health in UBC's Faculty of Medicine and a past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She called on Canada to follow Germany's lead, which, in response to Fukushima, decided in May to phase out all of its nuclear power plants by 2022. If Germany can do it, we can too, she said in a phone interview from her Vancouver home. With 450,000 people homeless, a fallout across Metro Japan, and a damages bill estimated at $300 billion, Fukushima is the biggest industrial catastrophe in the history of mankind, said U.S. nuclear industry whistleblower Arnold Gunderson in a June 10th Al Jazeera story. Even the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which owns a Fukushima plant, has acknowledged that the disaster may surpass the 1986 Chernobyl catastrophe. The radiation leak has not stopped completely, and our concern is that the amount of leakage could eventually reach that of Chernobyl or exceed it, a TEPCO official said in an April media release. In the case of Chernobyl, radiation caused 985,000 deaths worldwide, including almost 170,000 in North America between 1986 and 2004, according to a Russian study published by the New York Academy of Sciences in 2009. Fallout contaminated about 100,000 square kilometers of land. And 25 years later, 5-7% of government spending in Ukraine is still devoted to dealing with the disaster's health, environmental, and other after effects. The impacts of Fukushima are still in the earliest stages of being determined, especially since the nuclear plant is still spewing huge amounts of radiation. On Monday, TEPCO reported detecting record-high radiation levels at the plant, double the previous record set in early June. The new level, at least 10 sieverts, 10,000 millisieverts per hour, could cause death or incapacitation within a few seconds exposure. Japan's Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, said in July that decommissioning the plant would take several decades. A fallout has contaminated food and water across Japan. In July, officials reported that Japanese consumers had eaten meat contaminated with radioactive material. Cattle feed at one farm had levels of radioactive cesium, 57 times higher than the government ceiling. Japanese investigators later determined that almost 3,000 cattle had eaten radioactive feed before being shipped to market. Prices of Japanese beef collapsed after 23 out of 274 beef samples exceeded government radiation limits. In Tokyo, radioactive iodine in tap water reached double the government ceiling in March. Meanwhile, TEPCO reported in April that a seawater sample near the Fukushima plant contained 7.5 million times what was described as the legal amount of iodine-131. TEPCO released 11,500 tons of radioactive water from its storage tanks into the Pacific Ocean on April the 4th. One aspect of the fallout and seawater contamination that remains unclear is how it might affect fish stocks, especially migratory species like salmon that could pass through poisoned areas of the ocean, eat irradiated prey, or have radioactive water dumped in their home ranges by Pacific currents. Of the five species of Pacific salmon that are native to Western North America, the sockeye is the most commercially prized. It also has the most wide-ranging migration route through the North Pacific, swimming for 2 to 3 years, as far as just northeast of the top of Japan, before coming back to its natural streams in Alaska, BC, and the U.S. Northwest. These years-returning sockeye are just starting to be caught off Vancouver Island's west coast. So far, there's no word as to whether or not these fish will be tested. According to an April 17 story in the Anchorage Daily News, U.S. federal officials have already stated that there is no need to even test Alaskan salmon. Across the Pacific Ocean, it took only a few days after the disaster for radioactive fallout to start showing up in drinking water and milk across North America. Governments in both Canada and the U.S. monitor the radioactivity, but their data is reported in such a confusing and irregular way that it's extremely difficult to determine if maximum contamination levels have been exceeded and how public health is being impacted. It's very, very difficult to interpret radiation levels detected from Fukushima and translate them into standards. It's a nightmare, said Arjun Makajani, an electrical and nuclear engineer and president of the Tacoma Park, Maryland-based Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, in a phone interview. And that's not a coincidence, said Vanier College's Gordon Edwards. To me, it's a way of obscuring the impacts. It's a smokescreen. Dale Dewar agrees. The government always downgrades the results. They want to soft-pedal the extent of the accident because it will threaten our own nuclear industry, said Dewar, a family physician and the executive director of Canadian anti-nuclear group Physicians for Global Survival, in a phone interview from her home near Wynyard, Saskatchewan. One of the highest post-Fukushima radiation readings in North America came on March 27 in rainwater in Boise, Idaho. It contained 14.4 becquerels of iodine-131 per liter, 130 times the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's maximum contamination level of 0.11 millibecquerels per liter. EPA officials said in media reports that the high levels didn't pose a health threat. For the agency to sound an alarm, it says, a person would have to exceed its maximum level for an entire year, drinking 2 liters of the contaminated water each day. But nobody seemed to investigate how long the rainwater in Boise remained radioactive. Inexplicably, the EPA stopped monitoring Boise's rainwater after the extremely high reading on March 27th. The agency's only other reading for the city was on March 22nd. That day, the iodine-131 level hit 9 becquerels per liter. In fact, if the two readings are averaged out and stay just as elevated over the entire 6-day period from March 22 to 27, a person drinking the Boise rainwater during this time would have exceeded the EPA's annual ceiling by 75%. In BC's lower mainland, iodine-131 in the rainwater hit almost the same level as in Boise. It also seems to have exceeded the EPA's ceiling. On March 19th, the iodine-131 levels in rainwater in Burnaby suddenly spiked from 0 to 9 becquerels per liter. The next day, it rose even further to 13, according to data collected and released by Krzysztof Starosta, an associate professor of chemistry at SFU, and others. The iodine-131 levels remained well above the background level, which is close to zero, for 12 days. The average level of radioactive iodine was 7 becquerels per liter over the 12 days. That means a person drinking 2 liters of rainwater per day would have consumed 166 becquerels of iodine-131 during that period. That's more than double the maximum amount the EPA says a person can drink in an entire year, which is 81 becquerels. Starosta did not respond to phone and email messages seeking comment. Starosta issued a statement on March 28 saying the levels were safe because they were lower than levels detected after the Chernobyl disaster. As of now, the levels we're seeing are not harmful to humans. We're basing this on Japanese studies following the Chernobyl incident in 1986, where levels of iodine-131 were 4 times higher than what we've detected in our rainwater so far, the statement said. The contaminated rainwater also didn't spark concern from Canadian public health officials. That's in large part because Canadian standards are far more lenient on radioactive contamination than those of the EPA. Canada allows 6 becquerels per liter of iodine-131 in drinking water, or 54 times more than the EPA. By that much higher Canadian ceiling, the rainwater in Burnaby was fine to drink. At the BC Ministry of Health Services, spokeswoman Laura Neufeld referred questions about radiation monitoring to Health Canada. A Health Canada spokesperson, Stephanie Shank, didn't return the Straits call. Shank is the same Health Canada employee who did not return calls regarding a recent Straits story on nanoparticles. It shows you these standards are not scientifically based, Edwards said. They're arbitrary and really based on political considerations. We have a government strongly committed to the export of uranium and promotion of nuclear energy. And even if the radiation level in Burnaby didn't hit the far higher Canadian ceiling, Edwards said, any amount of radiation can cause cancer and other illness. To suggest that a certain level of radiation exposure is safe is untrue. It verges on misrepresentation. There is no evidence that there is any safe level of radiation exposure. It means you should operate as far below that level as you can, he said. Either way, without adequate monitoring, we may never know the impacts on Canadians. And that was an article from Straight.com. It was entitled, Japan's Fukushima Catastrophe Brings Big Radiation Spikes to BC. It's published on August the 4th. This is the Huffington Post article regarding the Regulate Marijuana Like Wine Act. Ballot initiative would tax pot like wine. was published on August the 5th. I wrote down two things to talk about tonight. One was Perrone's charges being dismissed, and the other was the Cubby Regulate Marijuana Like Wine initiative. So here we have the Cubby Regulate Marijuana Like Wine initiative. Again, this is from the Huffington Post. The title is, it's under California Watch, Regulate Marijuana Like Wine Act, Ballot Initiative Would Tax Pot Like Wine. Supporters are gathering signatures for an initiative that would decriminalize marijuana in California for those older than 21. The measure, dubbed the Regulate Marijuana Like Wine Act, would tax and regulate the cultivation, production, and sale of cannabis using grape and wine industry standards. We're taking something that's unregulated and we're replacing it with a known successful program implemented by the California Alcohol Beverage Control Board, said co-author Steve Cubby, who also helped draft and promote Proposition 215, California's first medical marijuana law. We know it works great with wine. It's already in place. And just let me interject right here that Cubby did not help draft California's medical marijuana law. No, he didn't. The measure currently is written to exempt people from permitting fees who are growing up to 25 plants. But Cubby said he and others have decided to amend it to 12 plants per parcel. Commercial growers exceeding that limit would be subject to regulations and fees similar to those for grape farmers. Those selling cannabis products would be taxed and regulated under state rules that currently apply to wine and other alcoholic beverages, with an exception for hemp products with no hallucinogenic properties. If you're going to treat it like wine, you have to have an exemption for people who make their own wine or make their own cannabis, Cubby said. Now, if they sell it, then they have to pay tax on it. And the intent really is for you, for your own stash at home. The initiative also bars state government and law enforcement officials from assisting the federal government in prosecuting individuals for marijuana use or cultivation. We all understand that federal law will trump state law in this regard, said Jim Gray, a former judge and co-author of the measure. So we're telling the federal government, we know you can enforce it, but if you're going to, you have to do it by yourself. And by the way, you're going to have to come to a jury of Californians, and I think getting a conviction will be problematic. Concerns over federal opposition helped defeat Proposition 19, a measure on a 2010 ballot that would have legalized cannabis, said Dale Jones, chairwoman of the Coalition for Cannabis Policy Reform. She said the group has been collecting polling data in preparation for an initiative of its own. We asked for a tremendous amount of feedback, she said, explaining that many people were apathetic about Proposition 19. Just got to make a note to come back and talk about this apathetic about Prop 19. I sure as hell was not apathetic. A lot of us were not apathetic about Proposition 19. So this is Dale Scott Claire Jones, the Mrs. Tomatoes are taxed woman, Chancellor of Oakland, Oaksterdam U. She was a chancellor. You got this, folks. This woman calls herself a chancellor at Oaksterdam U, and she stands up at the hemp con in Los Angeles last year and tells the assembled multitudes that tomatoes are taxed. But you know what is shocking to me is I ask people, I've asked a number of people, you know, people are 20 or 30 years old and don't know that tomatoes are not taxed. They don't know that groceries are not taxed. They don't know that pharmaceuticals are not taxed. These people don't know anything. It's just it's truly frightening. But let's get back to this article, okay? Well, I was reading from this article in the Huffington Post about the Cubby Initiative. And so we've got Dale Skye Jones talking here. Concerns over federal... this is Dale Skye Jones. Concerns over federal opposition helped defeat Proposition 19, a measure on a 2010 ballot that would have legalized cannabis, said Dale Jones, chairwoman of the Coalition for Cannabis Policy Reform. You know, there's just so much wrong with that sentence. It wasn't legalization. Bill Panzer said it was not legalization. A poll conducted by Peter Lewis, the Ohio insurance magnate, this exit poll conducted by Peter Lewis showed that 31% of those who voted against Proposition 19 favored legalizing marijuana. Now, let me try to get through this sentence here in the Huffington Post here one more time. Dale Skye Jones here, the chancellor of Oaksterdam U, the lady who believes that tomatoes are taxed. Concerns over federal opposition helped defeat Proposition 19, a measure on the 2010 ballot that would have legalized cannabis, said Dale Jones, chairwoman of the Coalition for Cannabis Policy Reform. She said the group has been collecting polling data in preparation for an initiative of its own. We ask for a tremendous amount of feedback, she said, explaining that many people were apathetic about Prop 19 because they believed federal intervention would have been inevitable. She also said the campaign was significantly hurt because it didn't have the full backing of the medical cannabis community. The Regulate Marijuana Like Wine Act prohibits commercial advertising for the sale or use of marijuana, but exempts medical cannabis. And the initiative explicitly states that it would not repeal, modify, or change Proposition 19 or any related laws. We're not touching anything that goes on with medical, Cubby said. That's the way it is. We don't touch that. If it's a medical grow and they sell to a dispensary, that's outside of our initiative. I just want to interject here. This is one of my problems with this, is that what it's going to do is by setting statewide the taxes, the sin tax on marijuana at 1.8%. This is significantly lower than the sin taxes that have been passed by Long Beach, Oakland, Sacramento, San Jose, Los Angeles, and just about every large city and many small ones in the state. You are still standing is the Rancho Cordova fee of $15,000 for a 25 square foot medical grow. That's $15,000 licensing fee per year in Rancho Cordova for a 25 square foot grow. Now let me read this sentence here from the Huffington Post one more time. By the way, if, for those of you that don't know, Steve Cubby is Mr. Medical Marijuana Poster Boy who's saying this. We're not touching anything that goes on with medical, Cubby said. That stays the way it is. We don't touch that. If it's a medical grow and they sell to a dispensary, that's outside of our initiative. Jones said the Prop 19 campaign tried similar tactics but was unsuccessful. She said there is a common fear among medical cannabis dispensary owners and the people who grow for them that legalization would hurt their business. Well, yes, they were trying to run them out of business is what they were trying to run all the medium-sized grows out of business is what they were trying to do. Proposition 19 would have allowed any city or county to ban cultivation and distribution, commercial cultivation and distribution. The courts would have interpreted this to include medical marijuana. And so, yes, it would have run most cultivators and distributors out of business. They would have been banned. back to the article in the Huffington Post. Jones said that the Prop 19 campaign tried similar tactics but was unsuccessful. She said there is a common fear among medical cannabis dispensary owners and the people who grow for them that legalization would hurt their business. Now, it's not legalization that would hurt their business. That's not the fear. This woman just drives me up a wall. It's not legalization that would hurt their business. It's these taxes and these regulations. These taxes without limit. These regulations without limit. This woman is speaking doublespeak. Do you understand this, folks? I really despise her. Quote, we did have some medical cannabis growers that understood that their profit margin wasn't worth getting people, putting people in prison. But I don't know if we will ever get them all, she said. I'd rather focus on getting the mainstream voters. The growers could vote yes, go legit, continue to make a living, and also pay a little more in taxes for their kids' public education. Taxes for their kids' public education. Hello, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
That's not legalization. That's not the fear. This woman just drives me up the wall.
What was that again? Hello? Hello? Well, I didn't hear what you said. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Yes. Do you hear me?
Yes, I can. What's up?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but back in the days of Prohibition, I see cannabis going this pretty much the same direction in that, you know, speakeasies and things of that nature. And then it was, well, not quite the same, but then the people who were allowed to sell alcohol were rabbis and priests because it was dealing with the religion. Then medical doctors were able to sell alcohol as a nerve tonic, and then it got legal. So I can see it going in pretty much the same direction, but the thing with taxes and everything, that's just a whole can of worms.
Well, I did you read Proposition 19? Do you live in California? I guess you
I do. And was it put together mostly by the person at Oaksterdam?
Well, it was funded solely by Richard Lee. The signature gathering campaign was funded solely by Richard Lee. I believe it was $1.4 million of money that patients spent on medicine that he put into gathering signatures to put that on the ballot. Yes. He toward the end he got contributions from Facebook and Soros, several million. I don't know how much.
I heard that he really, there was one person before him that was trying to get an initiative going. I failed to remember his name.
One person that what?
That was trying to get the initiative going. And I think the guy died or something of that nature. And anyway, the guy at Oaksterdam, he took it in a completely different direction, more industrial and big pharma. Well, compared to big pharma type of thing, as opposed to the little grower and things of that nature.
Let me ask you: did you vote in the last? Did you vote in November?
Yeah, and I did vote for it simply because it was a way of opening things up a little bit more and going in that direction. It wasn't a really well written bill from what I understand. But I want it out there in the general public. I want it not decriminalized. I want it legal.
Well, yeah, I do too. And the thing is that it would have allowed any local jurisdiction to ban the cultivation and distribution, and the courts would have interpreted that to mean medical. And so the supply would have been limited, and so the prices would not have gone down, I don't think. I read it very carefully, and as a matter of fact, there were three initiatives trying to get on the ballot last year. The person who died that you were talking about, I think, was probably Jack Herer. And I actually think that 2 weeks, he was planning on being in Santa Cruz 2 weeks after he died, had the stroke Hempstock, I think it was. 2 weeks after that, I think he had planned to be in Santa Cruz and launch the initiative drive for his initiative, the Jack Hare Initiative, which is called the California Cannabis Hemp and Health Initiative, which, by the way, this article that I was reading from the Huffington Post did not mention. They never mentioned this initiative, and this is by the initiative that was written primarily by Jack Hare with the help of his lawyer, Bill McPike.
I didn't read that. Did you read that and think that that was a much better? I heard it was a much better way of getting the whole thing going in a direction of legalization.
Oh yes, I did read it. I've written articles about it, numerous articles about it. I was terrified that I really wanted it to be on the ballot. I was terrified that Prop 19 would win, and I saw that as a huge step back, putting everybody back on the firing line again. There are cases currently going through the courts now where cities and counties have banned dispensaries, and these are being challenged as being in conflict with Prop 215, and these cases would not have a leg to stand on under Prop 19. Jack Hare's initiative, you asked me about it, and it, for one thing, it explicitly exempted medical patients from any taxes. It limited the amount of tax you could charge to $10 per ounce, and of course the percentage increases as the price goes down. But still, $10 an ounce is, you know, when you're paying $200-$300 an ounce now for medical grade, and you know, people in Oakland are paying like 15%, 20% tax, something like that, on their medicine. But the Jack Hare Initiative exempted medical from any taxes. It also has a license fee. It sets a limit on the amount a license can be cost. It's $1,000 to cultivate, to distribute. So it sets a limit on those fees, as opposed to cities like Long Beach and Oakland. Oakland is charging $30,000, $60,000, $90,000 for a dispensary license. They were going to try to charge $120,000 for these big grows licenses. And so it sets limits of $1,000 for license to cultivate and distribute. It sets the limits of the tax for $10. It gives amnesty for anyone that was convicted of a marijuana crime. If your only conviction is a marijuana crime, you get out of jail when it passes. It makes hemp legal. There's so many ways it's superior. You know, when all this started, I think it was February of 2 years ago, when Tom Amiano introduced his legislation, and they came up with this $1.4 billion in taxes. Tom Amiano's legislation exempted medical from the tax. And I don't particularly have a problem with taxing recreational use, but I think that medicine should not be taxed, and it is medicine, and taxing it is taking the medicine out of it, medical out of it, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree.
But in the last election, there were actually three other initiatives. There was the Jack Hare Initiative, but they weren't really making a serious try to get on the ballot, quite frankly. They were in pretty much disarray with Jack Hare's stroke and his subsequent... He was in a coma pretty much until he died. There's people who say that he was able to speak to them, and some people said he never was able to speak and he stayed in a coma until he died on tax day, on April the 15th. As a matter of fact, he died on tax day.
So is there a group or somebody with the frame of mind similar to his that is moving forward relative to this next election?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I saw Michael Jolson yesterday at the Cabrillo Music Festival over there at City Hall. And he is in Santa Cruz, and he's trying to carry on and get the Jack's Initiative on the ballot. And they have a website, which is www.CCHHI2012.org. That's CCHHI2012.org, California Cannabis Hemp and Health Initiative 2012. And they're not, they're hoping to file the initiative, I think, in November or thereabouts, and start collecting signatures. You know, after you get an official title in summer. You have 150 days to collect signatures and get the million or so you need to get it on the ballot. And so Michael said that they're not doing too well. They're trying to get donations. They don't have any big money behind them. See, there's nobody who's going to get rich off of this Jack Hare initiative. Not like they would off of Proposition 19. So there's nobody putting, $1 million of their own money into it because they'll be sitting in a monopoly. So Jolson told me that they had like $5,000 from one contributor and a couple hundred from some others. And they're trying to get a fundraising campaign going. And one of the ideas they floated is having people go to door and ask for contributions. And I guess giving people a percentage of the contributions they receive. I don't know exactly how they pay them, but they were saying they were going to pay people to go to door to solicit funds to get it on the ballot. And actually, Dan Cooper, who is... I guess you'd call him a political consultant here in Santa Cruz, is on board, and several other people. And so I guess we'll see where it goes. They feel like they have an uphill battle, and the biggest thing is they don't have big money behind them. There's nobody like George Soros who's going to dump, $50,000, $100,000 or more into it.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could say that, going that direction of big taxation and things like that, versus the people that, medical tax, things like that, I guess they were hoping for the trickle-down theory, that you would save money anyway.
Well, yeah, that's what they claimed. I remember the RAND study drew a lot of attention, claiming I think it would be as cheap as $40 or $20 per ounce. And you just... I don't know. It might get that low. John Entwistle was actually using the example of tobacco, which he said is about as labor-intensive as cannabis. It's about $12 a pound. He said it's about $12 a pound. It's, about half an ounce in a pack of cigarettes, and so that's $10 for an ounce. Actually, it's more than $12 a pound. It's about... but that's retail. You're talking about retail, and then the cigarettes are wholesale. So he said he worked it out to $12 a pound, and so I suppose you could say that cannabis could get down to that, but I don't think that's going to happen. It certainly wasn't going to happen under Proposition 19, and what it would have done is it would have set... You would have every city and town battling over zoning and taxes, and to ban or not to ban, and to tax or not to tax, and it would have been helter-skelter. I mean, it would have been just a Byzantine maze of, one jurisdiction to the next. You cross the city line, a county line, and the laws are completely different.
That would have been a crazy thing.
Yeah, I have been supporting the Jack Hare Initiative, the California Cannabis, Hemp, and Health Initiative. It hasn't gotten much press. I guess nobody thinks it has a chance in hell of getting on the ballot. We'll see. Hopefully it will do well. I believe they're going to be, actually Michael Jolson told me that they were having signature or meetings with Dan Cooper at the Santa Cruz Roasting Company on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, and I probably shouldn't talk about that because I haven't heard that in several weeks, and I'm not sure that's accurate. I know I went through there once or twice looking for them and didn't see them, but they do have a website. They are on Facebook, actually, and they've been very active trying to drum up interest on Facebook.
Well, I just have to search more for the facts. And be a little bit more diligent about reading further into what's going on. And I appreciate your help, but I got to get going, okay?
Well, thanks. I hope you'll call back again.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye. Whoever you were. You can hear the fan in the background. So... Did we completely lose the continuity of the article there? I was talking about Dale Sky Claire Jones. Let me finish. Thanks for calling in, caller. Let me finish this article in the Huffington Post here. Jones said that the Prop 19 campaign tried similar tactics, but was unsuccessful. This is at the Cubby Initiative. She said there is a common fear among medical cannabis dispensary owners and the people who grow for them that legalization will hurt their business. We did have some medical cannabis growers that understood that their profit margin wasn't worth putting people in prison, but I don't know if we will ever get them all, she said. I'd rather focus on getting the mainstream voters. The growers could vote yes, go legit, continue to make a living, and also pay a little more in taxes for their kids' public education. Gray also sees the challenge of getting the medical cannabis community's vote, but he said he thinks the initiative can win without their support. Did you hear that, folks? Did you hear that? Let me read this again. Gray also sees the challenge of getting the medical cannabis community's vote, but he said he thinks the initiative can win without their support. Well, thank you very much. Yes, some people presently in the medical marijuana dispensary business will vote against our initiative because they want to protect their market share, he said. And from an economic standpoint, they may be right. But the vast number of people who are involved in this, from a patient standpoint, from a law enforcement standpoint, from a parental standpoint, they will see the benefits from the strictly regulated sale of marijuana, and they will vote for this if we do our jobs right. I'd just like to say something. You know, none of the primary people that opposed Proposition 19, not Letitia Pepper, not me, I'm a patient. I don't have a dispensary. I can't even grow my own. Most of the people I knew, you know, this is a big lie here. I've got an article, I think it's the one I talk, Scott Emery and Scott and what's her name, Emery trash Dragonfly de la Luz on Facebook. In that article, I talk about Russ Belville and his I Got's Mine attack. And this is the same thing. The people that are opposed to these initiatives primarily are the patients. It's not the owners. The owners are for them. The owners know this gives them a monopoly. When you limit the number of dispensaries and you have high license fees, this limits their competition. The higher the bar, the better they like it, because that limits their competition. It gives them a monopoly. Let me just read this quote again from Judge Jim Gray. Yes, some people presently in the medical marijuana dispensary business will vote against our initiative because they want to protect their market share, he said. And from an economic standpoint, they may be right. But the vast number of people who are involved in this, from a patient standpoint, from a law enforcement standpoint, from a parental standpoint, they will see the benefits from the strictly regulated sale of marijuana. And they will vote for this if we do our jobs right. The Legislative Analyst Office said that depending on the response of the federal government, the proposed law could save tens of millions of dollars annually by lowering incarceration rates and raise hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. In June, U.S. Reps Ron Paul of Texas and Barney Frank of Massachusetts introduced legislation that would allow states to tax and regulate cannabis without interfering from the federal government. However, as California Watch recently reported, the Department of Justice has intensified its efforts to crack down on cannabis production in California. Supporters have until December 19 to collect the more than 500,000 signatures needed to put the initiative on the ballot. If passed in the November 2012 election, using cannabis while driving a car or at work or providing cannabis to a minor would remain illegal. Now, okay, you can't work, you can't drive a car. So, what can you do? Anyway, that was from the Huffington Post regarding the Regulate Marijuana Like Wine initiative. So, I guess they can amend it. You know, I wonder if they're going to resubmit it. You know, Dennis Perone told me that they don't have any, the Cubby Initiative doesn't have any money, that it's not a threat, it's not going anywhere. And there's been confusing stories coming out about it. This article said they're going to reduce the number of plants from 25 to 12 that you can grow. Now, this is essentially going to establish a limit for medical patients, is what this limit in this Regulate Marijuana Like Wine initiative is going to create. By the way, the caller's question about the Jack Hare initiative. The Jack Hare initiative has a limit of 99 plants. Essentially, anything under 99 plants can be personal use. If you are selling it, then it becomes commercial. Anything over 99 plants, I guess, is commercial, according to the Jack Hare Initiative. And the figure of 99 plants is just simply, it has more to do with the fact that the feds aren't going to bother with anything under 100 plants. At least that's what they say. So, Steve Cubby, now, back in, what year was that? 2000 or thereabouts, he was growing, he and his wife were growing 280 plants in Tahoe, and he got raided, and he actually beat the rap on the marijuana charges, claiming that 144 plants were for his personal use, then he went on the lam up to Canada and sat up there for years, getting $25,000-$30,000 a year in donations, from what I hear. Anyway, this initiative, he said he's going to reduce the plants from 25 to 12, and I think it's too late to amend it. I know they already amended it once and took out the health resource offices, or whatever they call those people, the Stitch Brigade. There was a whole section that they took out that's not in what you currently see at the on the Attorney General's website. But I think they're going to be resubmitting it. I guess we'll see what happens. And as far as people being apathetic about 19, well, you know, they added, you know, Prop 19 did not remove a single law from the books. In fact, it added one crime, and that would be for someone, I believe it was from 18 to 21, to pass a joint to someone from 16 to 18 or something like that. It was another crime. Providing for someone under 21, I think. And so the kids absolutely got nothing out of this. Why should they come out and vote for it? They basically offended every demographic except law enforcement and soccer moms. Looking for some music here to fill the time while I look for another article or something else to talk about. Beautiful day out there. Warm. I guess you can hear the fan in the background. Oh, this is a good one. This is Dale Schaefer. Dale Schaefer's in jail for 5 years. And most excellent speech.
I don't think I need to stand up on a step, but pull it up for all of you to see me, I believe. What do you think about my son?
Good son. Yeah.
I have five of them, and I have two grandchildren, and my youngest daughter is having a child in October. And this is what we're leaving behind. It's very difficult to find the words to express how I feel, how I should feel about this, when I have to leave such a beautiful family behind, and especially considering what I actually did. Yeah. Now, the medical marijuana laws were enacted by the Californians, but it's very obvious that the federal government and even the law enforcement folks in California want to hold on to the old lies that have been told for so many generations about this plant. In 1937, outright lies were told to our Congress to get the Marijuana Tax Act passed. Thousands of people went to prison. for doing nothing more than using medicine they've been using all their life. We have to thank Timothy Leary for getting rid of that old 1937 Tax Act, because he challenged it. The Supreme Court said, of course, it's unconstitutional. But that didn't stop the federal government. Richard Nixon came right in and, with Congress's help, brought another lie to this plant when they enacted the 1970 Controlled Substances Act and put marijuana in Schedule 1, which says it has no accepted medical use and it's too addictive to be used. Now, that has been proven over and over again to be a lie, but it continues to be used. It was used in my trial. We almost got somewhere with Jimmy Carter, because he was thinking about decriminalizing marijuana. Unfortunately, his drug czar, Peter Bourne, got caught around some people smoking pot and snorting cocaine, and Jimmy Carter had to get tough on drugs. And then came Ronald Reagan, who outright declared war on drugs again, and we got his wife Nancy breathing down everybody's throat about marijuana again. Now, the government did sort of the right thing by starting what they call the IND, the Investigational New Drug Study, where they gave some people that were going blind and basically dying the right to use medical swag from the government. We have one of our friends, L.D. Muzica, who's still alive up in Oregon. They get 300 medical marijuana joints a month. We brought L.D. to our trial. She wasn't even allowed to come in. They didn't want anyone to know that the federal government might, in fact, be using medical marijuana. That was kept away from the jury. Now, after they took marijuana away from medicine, it stopped being taught. But when they discovered the endocannabinoid system in the 1980s, they have to now teach medical students about the endocannabinoid system. This plant triggers a system in our body that's responsible for homeostasis. The most important thing in our body is affected by cannabinoids. We're now trying to figure this out, but the pharmaceutical companies want to take these chemicals and they want to patent them and sell them as drugs. We need to keep the plant whole. Let it do what it does and what it's done for thousands of years. We need to allow people who can to grow their own. Yeah. Yeah. We fought for years up in our neck of the woods, which is a production area, to allow people to grow their own. I ran for district attorney in my county so that we could get county guidelines. That was one of the reasons why I'm in the predicament I'm in right now. I sort of pissed off some people who didn't want one of them to be involved in law enforcement. Now, Molly and I also went to trial multiple times, and we stood behind our notes, and Molly got at least 25 people out of trouble, got them acquitted because she testified on their behalf. Now, that irritates district attorneys. I'm a trial lawyer. I know when I go to trial, I want to win. And when I lose, I want to know why. And they knew why. They knew why because Molly Fry dared to stand up and tell them they're wrong and leave this sick person alone. And juries almost universally told the poor sick person to go home, and they wanted to have a come to Jesus talk with that district attorney about why you dared to do this. We also advertised on the radio. How dare us? Today, their advertisements are everywhere. I looked in Sacramento News and Review. There were pages and pages of them. They're all over the place. But 10 years ago, we were on the forefront. So what we did was to get under the skin of a lot of people who wanted to shut us up. Now, they waited until Angel Reich's case was decided by the Supreme Court. And within 2 weeks of that case being decided in June of 2005, we were indicted and arrested. They tried to get rid of my attorney, Tony Serra, by throwing him in jail, but it didn't happen. He still maintained his position as my attorney and came back to try my case. They tried to get rid of Tony Serra and Larry Lichter for a conflict of interest. The judge didn't allow that. We finally got our trial, but the jury had blinders on, and they were not allowed to see or hear the evidence of what had actually happened to us. What I was convicted of is what I basically admitted on the stand. that I grew marijuana for my wife and for myself and for a handful of sick people. The numbers, I believe, were 106. And once you get to that magic number of 100, they have you. That draconian minimum mandatory sentence is going to get 5 years of federal prison if you dare to have over 100 plants. That conspiracy law can be used to stretch it over 5 years, which is the statute of limitations for manufacturing marijuana.
That was Dale Schaefer. He was sentenced to 5 years. He's in jail now, unfortunately. And that was back in May the 14th. It was published on YouTube back in May. Found a couple of quick items here. They're fairly important. This one particularly, this is, I'm going to be reading from the Weedly News. It's from Normal by Dale Geringer. It came out on July the 22nd. It was published. The title is L.A. Court Rules. Patients must have specified dosage. Important mainly because of the words in the message. You know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Does that make a lot of sense to you? L.A. court rules patients must have specified dosage, important mainly because of the words in the message. Something missing there. But anyway, that's the title of the article. In an unprecedented ruling, a Los Angeles court denied a motion by plaintiff and DPFCA member Susan Soares. That's the Drug Policy Foundation. In an unprecedented ruling, a Los Angeles court denied a motion by plaintiff and DPFCA member Susan Soares to return her medical marijuana on the grounds that her doctor had not specified a dosage amount or frequency in her recommendation. Soares, who was growing for a local collective, had her medicine seized by hostile police last March and had petitioned the court for it to be returned after charges against her were dropped. It is generally the practice of most medical cannabis specialists never to prescribe a dosage quantity. The California Medical Association recommends that physicians never do so because no dosage guidelines for cannabis have ever been established. Effective dosage varies greatly according to the potency and delivery form of the medication. Patients regularly control their own dosage through self-titration. In the court's decision, Judge Antonio Barreto Jr. declared that, as a matter of law, any recommendation that Soares' doctor made that does not involve frequency and dosage both is insufficient, period, and does not lead to any lawful possession of any amount of marijuana. The judge mysteriously stated that his ruling was based on the Trippett decision. Soares had been growing for several patients, but the court declined to return even 6 plants for her own individual use. Soares is seeking legal aid to appeal Barreto's unprecedented decision. Susan Soares wrote, "I was denied my motion to return yesterday based on People versus Trippett. The judge said that because my doctor didn't give me dosages or frequency of use, that my rec was invalid and therefore he couldn't even give me the SB 420 limits back. My attorney then asked him to preserve the evidence until we have time to appeal, and he refused. The case that he referred to is pre-215, and later the convictions were vacated when 215 passed. The DA and the cops started cheering. Now the cops are going to wrongly believe that there has to be dosages on people's recs. What can I do?" So that was last week. It was interesting that Susan Soares was in charge of speakers for the Hemp Expo in San Francisco. This is a quote from the San Francisco Examiner, I believe. It could be the Chronicle. Back last year, a news release from the Expo said Susan Soares, who is planning speakers for the event, contacted over a dozen opponents of the proposition, all of whom have declined to attend the event and participate in the debate. Well, there was Dennis Perrone, there was Lynette Davies, there was a whole bunch of people, Letitia Pepper, a whole bunch of people just dying to get up there and debate these people on Proposition 19. These were marijuana legalization advocates, medical marijuana patients who were opposed to Proposition 19, and they were just dying to get up on that podium and debate these people. And so this is the woman who said, quote, "A news release from the expo," said Susan Soares, who is planning the speakers' panels for the event, "contacted over a dozen opponents of the proposition, all of whom have declined to attend the event and participate in the debate." Well, they wanted to frame it as legalization versus prohibition rather than as thinly veiled prohibition, which is what it was. But that's just a little aside there. In Ohio, they had thought they had more than enough signatures to get their petition on the ballot. This is for medical marijuana. And it failed. There was like, they turned in, I think, 2,000-something signatures, and only 500 of them were good. I think they tried to get twice as many as they needed, and only a quarter of them were any good. So they didn't qualify for the ballot. This is from the 420 Times. Ohio medical marijuana petition rejected. This is August the 4th. The journey for a group of advocates attempting to legalize medical marijuana in Ohio has stumbled on its first step as the group failed to submit 1,000 ballot signatures to state officials. Last week, we told you about advocates submitting 2,143 signatures to the state's attorney general, but it seems barely 500 of those turned out to be valid. Advocates must now start over and get 1,000 ballot signatures before their petition can be approved, and they can begin the arduous task of getting over 385,000 signatures for their Ohio Alternative Treatment Amendment. But to make that happen, the group will need to get much better at the signature gathering because a less than 25% success rate on valid signatures is not going to get anything on the ballot. 50% is the goal of most petition drives. There is also another group currently trying to get a measure on the ballot in Ohio legalizing medical marijuana, and time will tell how successful they are. A third option is a bill currently in the Ohio legislature that would also bring relief to Buckeye patients. And this last article here, it's kind of interesting article. It's in a Reason online. It was August the 5th, 2011. How many medical marijuana patients are fakers, and does it matter? By Jacob Sullivan. A recent survey of 1,746 patients at 9 medical marijuana evaluation clinics in California indicates that the patient population has evolved from mostly HIV, AIDS, and cancer patients to a significantly more diverse array. University of California at Santa Cruz sociologist Greg Reinerman and his colleagues, who report their results in the Journal of Psychoactive Studies, say this trend toward increasing therapeutic uses is bringing marijuana back to the position it held in the U.S. pharmacopoeia prior to its prohibition in 1937. Reinerman et al. Found that relief of pain, spasms, headache, and anxiety, as well as to improve sleep and relaxation, were the most common reasons patients cited for using medical marijuana. The top three reasons physicians gave for recommending marijuana were back, spine, neck pain, 31%, sleep disorders, 16%, and anxiety, depression, 13%. Although these may sound like easy-to-fake symptoms, four-fifths of the patients reported trying other doctor-prescribed medications, most commonly opioids, before marijuana. They could have been malingering then too, of course, and it may be easier to get a recommendation for marijuana than it is to get a prescription for Vicodin or Valium. But on the whole, it does not look like allowing the medical use of marijuana has fundamentally changed the nature of the doctor-patient relationship. Doctors do, after all, commonly prescribe psychoactive pharmaceuticals to treat not only pain but also sleep disorders, anxiety, and depression, all with the government's blessing. If some people find that marijuana works better for these purposes, there is no rational reason to prevent them from using it. While it is true that a great majority of our respondents had used marijuana recreationally, Wienerman et al. Write, over two-fifths reported that they had not been using it recreationally prior to trying it for medical purposes. The authors are keenly aware of the widespread impression that a large portion of California's medical marijuana patients are using phony or exaggerated ailments as an excuse to get high. They note that it is hard to measure the extent of such diversion and that the phenomenon is not limited to marijuana. More fundamentally, they suggest that the distinction between medical and non-medical use of drugs is becoming increasingly difficult to draw. Beyond the spread of medical marijuana, Prozac and other SSRI-type antidepressants, for example, are often prescribed for patients who do not meet DSM criteria for clinical depression, but who simply feel better when taking it. Such cosmetic psychopharmacology is likely to grow as new psychiatric medications come to market. The line between medical and non-medical drug use has also been blurred by performance-enhancing drugs such as steroids, so-called smart drugs that combine vitamins with psychoactive ingredients, and herbal remedies like Mawang, Ephedra, available in health food stores. These examples suggest that despite the best intentions of physicians and lawmakers, much drug use does not fit into two neat boxes, medical, non-medical, but rather exist on a continuum where one shades into the other as patients' purposes shift to suit situational exigencies in their health and their daily lives. It is not clear where a borderline between medical and non-medical marijuana or other drug use might be drawn, nor how it might be effectively policed. If you believe the government has no business drawing or policing this line, it is hard to get worked up about people who fake their way to a medical marijuana recommendation. But as I argued back in 1993, reformers could pay a price if all the talk about relieving the suffering of cancer and AIDS patients is perceived as a cover for recreational use. Politicians in other states commonly cite the California example is a reason to block medical use or restrict it to a short list of conditions. Then again, the perception that California's current law encourages dishonesty, much as the medical and religious exceptions to alcohol prohibition did, may strengthen support for outright legalization, which last fall attracted support from 46% of California voters. Well, there's a number of things wrong with this article. For instance, it ends calling Proposition 19 legalization and stating that the 40% of California voters support legalization because 46% of them voted for Proposition 19. Even though 31% of the 51% who voted against Proposition 19 supported legalizing marijuana. I think it's a lot more than 46% that support legalizing marijuana. The problem is that Proposition 19 was not legalization, and anybody that took the time to read it would have could see quite clearly that it was an unholy mess. There's other things wrong with this. One thing I wanted to point out is when the top three reasons here they give, physicians give for recommending marijuana were back pain, sleep disorders, and anxiety and depression. California, anxiety and depression here is 13%. California is the only state that allows marijuana to be used for depression or anxiety. There is no other state, no other medical marijuana law allows that. They've been trying for 10 years. To get it approved, the Oregon Committee to get it approved for depression and anxiety and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and they have been denied. Of course, this is pharmaceutical lobbying in these government committees. The biggest mistake that they ever made, that MPP made, and I think it was an intentional, is that they, after Proposition 215, they, with every other law, gave the government the authority to determine who was a legal medical marijuana patient. The fact is that other surveys have shown that about 60% of medical marijuana patients use it for pain. About 30%, the second largest demographic in California, use it for psychiatric conditions, for post-traumatic stress disorder, for anxiety, depression, bipolar. It stabilizes bipolar people. It levels them out, stabilizes them, normalizes them, and they also have better cognitive functioning. They are more intelligent. They're more focused. It's much safer than anything else they use for bipolar condition. What is that? Lithium is what they give. Oh, yeah, lithium is deadly. And the SSRIs are horrible. I've done other shows on how horrible they are, so I don't feel like doing another one. But these people don't really seem to know what they're... This is coming from Dale Geringer of Normal. And there's a lot wrong with it. I don't want to dwell on it all, but... he doesn't talk about harm reduction, so many other things. I found the figures interesting. I don't particularly like what they did with them, and I don't particularly like the conclusions they drew. I do tend to think that all cannabis use is medical. I think if anybody is using cannabis consistently after a couple of years experimentation when they're young, anyone that uses it consistently after that is using it for some medical reason. You know, I've met so many people that don't like it for one reason or another. Obviously, they don't have a medical need for it. It seems that the people who like it have a medical need for it, and the people who don't like it don't have a medical need. It's interesting that way. Just got a few minutes left. You've been listening to Canada on Cannabis. I'm Craig Canada, your host on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, streaming on the net. I've got archives on my show of the show on www.promspringsbum.org/blog/canada-on-cannabis, and that's my website. And at the bottom of that page, www.palmspringsbum.org/blog/canada-on-cannabis, the bottom of that page is a donate button if you like what you're hearing and want to help me pay my expenses. I think I'm going to go out with the Mamas and the Papas. And so... 1968. Did you hear that? I want to start this over. This is Ed Sullivan's show in 1968. Mamas and the Papas.
June 22nd, 1968.
All the leaves are brown.
Safe and warm, safe and warm. If I was in LA, if I was.
Ah, yes, sir. The Mamas and the Papas. California Dreaming. And next up, we'll be playing Smash Mouth. You might as well be walking on the sun. I open and close my show with that because it's what it's all about as far as I'm concerned.
Tears because our baby's life has been revoked. The bond is broke, got so choke up and foe. Kiss on the close up, Mr. Wizard can reform. No God like Hocus Pocus.